And then the hour of 1 o'clock having arrived, I'm going to call the Subcommittee on Legislative Process Reform to order. Representative, no, we won't go that far quite yet. Ms. Schaefel, will you take the roll?
Pawlowski.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Present.
Doubt.
Present.
Freiberg. Freiberg. Garofalo.
Present.
Haley. Haley. Liz Lagarde.
Present.
Moran. Moran. O'Neill.
Present.
Pinto.
Present.
Sandsted.
Present.
Mr. Chair, a quorum is present.
Ms. Schiff, you might want to go back. I think we had a couple of members just come on.
Freiberg.
Present. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Haley.
Present. Thank you as well.
And Moran.
Present.
Mr. Chair, a quorum is very present.
All right. Thank you. Representative Wolgamott, do you have a motion for us?
Mr. Chair, I've had the chance to thoroughly review the minutes from last week's meeting, and I would like to move their approval.
All right. Any discussion to the Wolgamott motion to approve the minutes? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. With that, I'm going to have a few introductory remarks, and then we'll proceed with the agenda that we had stopped at last week. This week we had a chairs meeting at the request of Speaker Hortman, and I was part of it. We went over the two letters of Governor Walz, the January 7th and the January 21st. The chairs were encouraged, highly encouraged, to take a look at those seven items that were in the January 7th letter and to begin to develop legislation to address if they were, if it was possible, to put those into some type of statutory context. So having said that, I would encourage the members of this committee to approach those chairs with whatever ideas you might have on developing those seven items. And obviously the governor had referenced more. I also want to encourage folks that you don't necessarily need to draft a bill and introduce a bill. We had seven special sessions with an array of legislation. You could take one of those bills from the previous seven special sessions, use it as a draft in committee, and work off that. Then once you have settled whatever the item is, you could incorporate that into a bill that they already have in the committee, or you could reintroduce it, of course, as a bill and do it as a standalone item. So I would hope that the problems that we're having with the revisor's office would not deter you from taking a look at any of those seven or at any of the revisions that you might want to do to Chapter 12. Representative Baker has also approached me about doing perhaps a week from today a presentation dealing with the first of the items that we had taken a look at last week, the executive order on businesses, and I encouraged him to put something together, and I think he's working with Representative Haley on that, and that the two of them might be involved in a presentation next week, particularly on that first executive order dealing with businesses. So that would be one item that would be possible for next week. Representative Jordan emailed all of us. She has a bill dealing with masks, and I think she's actually walking it around the state office building for signatures. So if you're interested in going on that bill, I don't know the context of the bill, but certainly it might be something you might be interested in. And finally, Mr. Sullivan sent us an email responding to an issue that was brought up by Representative O'Neill. It's a rather lengthy email, but if we have a question to it, I don't know if Mr. Sullivan is at the meeting today, but certainly you could, we could request him at the next meeting if you want to continue a discussion of that issue. Having said that, unless there are any questions on what I just brought up, Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In you and I had spoke before the committee started about my bill that I had worked on with the governor's office early on. If you, and I think that happened back in June or July, and we negotiated pretty extensively back and forth for about 3 weeks, and we ultimately kind of weren't able to get over one particular issue. But I would, if you're going to have a hearing or have a presentation next week, there, I would like the opportunity to just have a conversation about where we were and what was in that bill, and kind of what I see as some of the outstanding issues, namely, you know, should the legislature vote to end an emergency order or emergency powers, or should we vote to extend them? So I'd like to have an opportunity to discuss some of that. And I don't know that we need to belabor it with a lot of time, but if it was appropriate for you, Mr. Chair, I wouldn't mind doing that next week if you've got other things like that on the agenda.
Representative Dowd, I was hoping you would bring that up. So would you forward that to Mr. Wirth, Mr. Blauvelt, and then we'll have it on the agenda for next week?
I will
think
do
that. That would be a very pertinent item. And since you already have it in form, that might be the one we'd start with next week.
Yep, and I think if it's okay, Mr. Chair, we were actually going to make some updates to it because what I had was what we started with, and I don't know that we ever made a final version of where we ended with the governor's office. And then I can try to give you the information on where we were different, but sure. I should have that by Monday, I think, and I'll get that to you as soon as we've got it.
That would be excellent, and Thank you. That would be a great way. We don't need to introduce it as a separate bill. We can work off that draft.
Great, okay.
Any other questions, members, on anything that I started with today? Seeing no further questions, then we're going to continue where we left off. Representative Freiberg, you were next on the list for a question last week. I hope you remember what it was, and you can start us off with your question. And by the way, Assistant Commissioner Huff is here. So if you want to respond to any of the slides he brought up last week or information, certainly do so.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and my question is for Assistant Commissioner Huff. So one thing this committee is trying to determine is when decisions are better suited for legislative action and when they're better suited for executive action. I mean, as a general rule, the legislature does not act quickly. I mean, there are some exceptions to that rule, but generally, if you want bills to go through the proper committees in both chambers, it's going to take a few weeks, probably a few months more realistically. So what I'm wondering, Assistant Commissioner Huff, is just how long it takes to make some of the decisions that guide the executive orders. And just to take one example, in your testimony last week, you mentioned that pandemics can change to exponential growth with very little warning. So I'm wondering how long it took between when signs started indicating that there might be exponential growth of COVID-19 in mid-October and when the decision to dial back was made.
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Freiberg. Mr. Chair, I would love to refer to slide 11 in my presentation from last week, if that's appropriate. And good afternoon, everyone, members of the committee, and Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be back with you today, so thank you.
Thank you. We're having a little bit of an issue getting the slide up, but it'll be there at some point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will go ahead and just describe some of our thinking here. So, Representative Freiberg, I appreciate your reference to speed and how quickly sometimes we need to act. From a public health perspective, we are at war. We are at war with the virus. And as we know, things can change quickly on the battlefield, especially when we're dealing with an unpredictable enemy. COVID-19 is brand new to us. It has befuddled us in many ways. As we just in the scientific community throughout the world respond to the disease and we learn more. What we do know about any infectious disease, obviously, is that it requires people to pass it on to other people. And that's how it continues to propagate and to spread. So I think this slide shows us very cogently how we went from feeling pretty good about where we were to really being in a crisis point of view. I look at that, if we look at that line on October 19th, and you can see that in at that point, we really hit exponential spread, and that by November 9th, we had peaked. What's important here is that in October 19th, we were at 30 cases per 100,000 people. And we peaked at 120 cases per 100,000 people. Our hospitals began to fill up before then. We had seen significant pressure in healthcare, in what was happening as far as morbidity issues with people having severe disease and side effects of the disease. And I think I mentioned last time that the decision, you know, we had been working and we continue to work and discuss regularly how do we best manage the disease and how do we best manage based upon our case numbers and what we predict will be happening. But this happened very suddenly. And Commissioner Malcolm talked to the governor and said we are at a crisis point and we have to act. And it was a busy weekend. That call started Saturday morning. And that was when we had the dial back announced very next week. We know that that is sudden for businesses. We know that it's very difficult. Like I said, things change quickly on the battlefield. We continue to be concerned. Right now, we are doing very well in our numbers. As we announced yesterday, our test positivity for the first time in a while has dropped down below 5% into what we call our green zone. Overall case, new cases per 100,000 continues to drop as well. These are very good signs. That means that we are pushing the enemy back. Unfortunately, the enemy does have some super soldiers that it's sending into the battlefield with these new variants. We have discovered two of these variants in Minnesota. In fact, just since I met with you last week on Friday, on Monday, we had detected the P1 variant that was first found in both Brazil and Japan. That variant is very disturbing for us to see what appears to be a very high, not just infection rate, but reinfection rate. And we don't know a lot about that variant. We are actually collaborating with the CDC and the NIH to provide more information on our case here because it is the first case in the United States. These changes can happen quickly, which means that the case numbers can change quickly. And as I showed previously, and maybe we can turn to slide 8, please. Our hospitalizations, our ICU admissions, and our death track closely to case numbers. So as case numbers increase, we will see, although with a lag, increased hospitalization and increased death rates. So that's why we look so very carefully at our case numbers. Representative Freiberg, did that help address your question? Thank you.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes, it did. You know, I was primarily interested just in how long you need to make these decisions, and I'm gathering from what you said very quickly. So that does provide, at least in my mind, provide some evidence that, you know, we do need to have some sort of authority for the governor to be able to respond quickly as the situation dictates. You know, we can certainly tweak that authority as necessary, and that's why we're having these hearings. But I do think it's important that there be some sort of process in place. So thank you.
Representative O'Neill, would this be a good time for you to present your graphic while we have Assistant Commissioner Huff to perhaps respond to it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's something that I have been asked to take a look at, and I just want to see if this is something that the assistant commissioner has taken a look at. And sometimes we are in such a bubble here in Minnesota, and so I wanted to give it a state-by-state kind of quick look in one picture. And so let me start to share this screen here.
And Representative Lutzegaard and Sandstead, I have you next after Representative O'Neill.
Can you all see that?
Yes, I can see it.
Thank you. Okay, so let me explain what this is. Across the bottom here, where it says 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, these are the a rating of how restrictive each state is. So if you look all the way over here, that would be Iowa and South Dakota, our neighbors. They have some of the fewest restrictions. Oklahoma up here, ranking number one with the fewest state restrictions. Then along this side, you have the deaths. So this is just raw total of deaths, and this is from just a few days ago. And you go across the top, so these are the states with the highest numbers of deaths. The higher you go up here, the more deaths. So Arizona is ranked, so you can see where it says their death rate ranking is 51. So they included Washington, D.C., and so they rank number one. So they're kind of right in the middle with how many restrictions. Across the top, you've got Arizona, Pennsylvania, New Mexico, California, which you know that California is just devastated right now. They have a high number of deaths and a very high number of restrictions. And in fact, they rank with the highest number of restrictions. So I thought we could just take a look at this quickly because somebody had asked me to take a look into the numbers. And again, this is just a few days old. And across the top, again, these are states with high numbers of deaths. So you've got this one would be ranked number four with fewest number of restrictions and also very high death. Let's go to look to see where Minnesota is really quickly. So Minnesota actually is way down here. So we have quite a few number of restrictions, although not as bad as California, New Mexico, Connecticut. But we also have fairly low death. So we are in sort of the more fortunate ones that are under 10 right here. So the ranking is less than 10. We're at 9. I know that we have seen, you know, I've been a part of a lot of presentations from the administration, and they talk a lot about South Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin. So while those three states are barely restricted, they're very, very low restrictions. They are a little bit higher in the overall death, but they're not as bad as, say, these up in here. You look at, like, Virginia, the state of Virginia. I lived there for quite some time. They rank 16th, but they have very, very high. So they're the 16th best with low numbers of deaths, but they also are highly restrictive. So, you know, I tried to find some sort of pattern or logic to this, and it just seems rather with a little bit random. You could, if you just simply say, well, more restrictions are better, then you would go to this end and say, well, yep, so there are some states here, like Washington, D.C., Maine, Vermont, Hawaii. Yep, they have lots of restrictions and they have low deaths. But you also have them up here with very high restrictions and also high death. So I would caution us to think that, you know, they're completely related one to another. It, you know, maybe someone else could analyze this more, but I just wanted to show that because I have been asked to take a look at sort of state by state and the various number of restrictions versus the death rate. And there's also one just below this that has to do with unemployment. And you can imagine it's very simple. That one's fairly simple. So the less restrictions, the less you have for unemployment factors. So I simply wanted to share that as a part of the conversation and just wondering if the administration has done something like this, if they've taken a look at this. Plus, I'd like to see country by country. I have one interesting look at India. So I've had the opportunity to go to India and see if I've got this up here still. India has just over a billion people, and they have had, well, they have had outbreak. It's about a quarter of the outbreak of the United States. So it's sort of a flip-flop. It's interesting. They've had high numbers of restrictions, a billion people. I was kind of going through their story, and yet they have considerably less infection and much less death in the United States. But they don't right now, they don't have nearly the kind of restrictions that we do. So I'm just wondering if the administration has taken a look. I only ask or say this to ask, have they looked at a state-by-state comparison like this? Have they looked at an international comparison and other studies, like I had presented the first hearing about the Stanford study showing, I think they looked at 16 different countries, and they could not find a correlation between high restriction and low death or better outcomes. And in fact, I think there was about a 2% better outcome in the less restrictive countries. And I'm just wondering, have you seen the same thing that I'm looking at in my data?
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill. I guess, first of all, we do look at national data. We do look at international data. One of the important things is we always look at what is the what are the data, what's the information around the data? So how were the data collected? Are there confounding variables that might be associated? So for example, you mentioned India. India has a much different public health surveillance program and system than the United States. The United States has a, as does Europe, has a very robust public health and healthcare surveillance system. So that I would say that we can be fairly confident that we have a high degree of detection of cases and of showing if deaths are associated with COVID. That may not be the case in other countries. When we look at the state comparison, which I think is one of the things that really that helps us get rid of some of those confounding variables. It's important to look at when did the spread occur and when did the peaks occur for particular states. For example, New York City there, or New York State, is quite high on both counts on the chart you just showed us for number of deaths or the death rate and whatever percentage. Or I guess I'm not quite sure that the X and Y axis aren't labeled. I don't know exactly how those are determined. But if we look at New York, was the first state to really be hit hard, and the surrounding states. I think they saw Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Connecticut in that area, in that, I guess, upper right quadrant. So a few things happened then. One is those restrictions were not in place when the surge hit. Those restrictions came into place after the surge had hit and after they had high death rate. The other thing is we were brand new to the disease. And, New York ran out of ventilators. They did not have the time to prepare, say, that we did in Minnesota, or in other parts of the country. They had not built up their supplies. You remember that, we lacked a real national or federal response to the disease, and every state was really on their own, as far as just equipment, where's PPE, and 95 masks were so scarce, as you might recall. We also did not have the medical advances that we have learned of how to treat the disease using remdesivir, using steroidal treatment, proning people who are sick with COVID. All of these things have meant that the death rate has dropped. Now it's about a 1% death rate, say even for Minnesota, where in May we were at about a 2.5% death rate. So that's significant. As the disease has progressed, we've learned more. The other thing I think is important to look at is how does the spike in deaths or the death rate compare to when restrictions were put into place? So as I mentioned, New York had restrictions in place after the spread had already really decimated many parts of the area, and really for the surrounding states as well. So Arizona was on there. Arizona is another example. Arizona did not have very many restrictions in place when their spike hit over the summer, but then they quickly put restrictions in place. There's actually an interesting article looking at what happened when those restrictions were in place for Arizona, and found that that actually did work and drove the cases downward. I think one of the things, and Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to go back to some of my reference slides here. And if I could go back to slide number 9.
Mr. Wirth, slide number 9.
Thank you, sir. Now, this is tracking us for our surrounding states. One of the interesting things about the way COVID has, you know, we've talked about that it has waves. The waves seem to be almost regionally based. So we had this northeast wave that hit that's where it hit the country first. Then we went to the Sun Belt or the South wave, mentioned Arizona there. And then it came up to the upper Midwest. And so you see that this wave hit all of us here. It hit Minnesota, Wisconsin, South Dakota, Iowa, and North Dakota in a very similar pattern. What's different, though, is Minnesota, our case rate started later. It was narrower and ended faster than most of our neighboring states. And then if you could go to the next slide, please. And this is really important to look at then, how did death rate occur? So death rate in the Dakotas and Iowa increased much more quickly during that surge than it did in Minnesota or Wisconsin. Well, actually, during that surge, Wisconsin increased faster than us. But the net result is, if North Dakota and South Dakota had the same death rate as Minnesota had the same death rate as the Dakotas, over 4,000 more Minnesotans would be dead. So I would say it, you know, it all depends on how an X and Y axis work as to how that graph, and I would like to study the data behind it. But that difference there in death rate means over 4,000 more Minnesotans are alive because of the measures we've taken in Minnesota. Now, another thing that impacts disease spread is density. The closer people are together and the more they interact with each other, the more likely the disease is to spread. It just makes sense. You got to be close to pass it to someone else. And the more people you have, the more likely it'll spread. The fact that Minnesota has such a higher population density than the Dakotas, and yet we had such a low death rate compared to the Dakotas, I think is significant as well. So I guess that would be, without being able to dive deeper into the slide you showed, that would be my immediate response. But more than happy to take a look at that, have our epidemiologist look at it, and then we can make further responses if that's helpful. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do appreciate that. We certainly want to have a deep dive into the understanding of not just our data here, but how we are in relation to others as well. Because, you know, I just came from the Public Safety Committee and we had Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge present. And they reminded us that the other side of the coin of the devastation of the pandemic is also skyrocketing mental health issues and chemical dependency and death by overdose. Even beyond that, all the folks that are not getting preventative care, so their cancer is not being detected. In my little tiny little town where I live, just in my block, there have been 3 deaths, 1 by suicide. Give me just a second. 1 by suicide. My very next door neighbor committed suicide. the sweet old Army veteran gentleman that lives right behind me fell in his home and no one found him for 3 days. And then another gentleman just died of a good old age just from heart failure, had nothing to do with COVID. But there are so many unreported, they are related to what we're doing with the shutdown and with the pandemic that we don't talk about. And so I just wonder if the administration also is looking at the ripple effect of these business shutdowns on people's mental health and the loss of their livelihoods and sometimes their retirement and their homes and whatever, just all of that they've invested into those businesses. I have an apartment on 7th Street here in St. Paul, and just in the one block from the Xcel Energy Center, almost all of the restaurants are closed. There's very few that are remained open, permanently closed. So I'm just wondering if the administration could just speak to that and how you balance all of that as well. Thank you.
Assistant Commissioner Huff, are you capable of answering that one, or do we need to get someone on board for next week?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take a stab at it. And then if we want to dive deeper, can refer to some other of our agencies. But if you'd like, I'm happy to provide a brief response to that.
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill. First of all, I am so sorry about the tragedy in your own neighborhood. The pandemic has affected each and every one of us in profound ways. In my own family, I have two children. They're teenagers. My son did not have a live graduation from high school. He didn't get to celebrate his 18th birthday. He's in college, and he says it's all the work and none of the fun because he doesn't get to do anything. My daughter is an adolescent girl. That's a very tough age. And she has not seen her friends in months. I worry deeply about my own children. I worry about their mental health. I worry about their emotional health. I worry about their social development. I think that's true of every parent in Minnesota. Governor Walz, at the very beginning of the pandemic, recognized that this disease was going to impact Minnesota in many, many ways beyond just the epidemiologic way. And as a result, he set up particular work teams, made up their interagency, so made up of experts and staff from all of the different agencies in the state, looking at vulnerable populations, looking at childhood and education, looking at food security, looking at economic security, looking at public safety. And each of these work groups have continued to work. They're all part of the daily briefing with the governor, and all of us work with each other. So, for example, as we look at the various executive orders, especially those that are impacting larger swaths of Minnesota, say through businesses or education or other factors, we all discuss that. So we have experts from all of those disciplines and all of those lenses saying, how will that impact us? How will that impact this population? How will this impact our young people, people who struggle with mental illness? That has been an absolute front and center part of all of these discussions. One of the things, and I want to go back to my analogy of us being at war. This is a public health war, and the things that we have to sacrifice during war are great. I think we've heard the stories of the greatest generation, our grandparents and great uncles and aunts who fought either at home or abroad in World War II. They suffered greatly, and I agree that we are suffering. However, I think that the peak that we saw in November showed what happens if we are not vigilant. We saw our hospitals fill up. We saw our healthcare heroes who were reduced to tears because of the amount of stress and strain and hours that they were trying to save people, to the fact that normal, if you had a heart attack during that period of time, you received less care because our hospitals were full of COVID. So I think it is definitely a balance, and everything we do has ramifications. So I appreciate you raising that balance, and please know that that has been on the top of all of our minds in the administration as we have attempted to navigate this extremely difficult public health emergency. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. I have a young daughter, 24 years old, who started her career as an RTR. So she's a radiologist technician and does CAT scan. And she started in December. So that child has been face-to-face with COVID patients for 12-hour shifts and I hear firsthand from her and her colleagues of what they've endured. And I get that and I understand that. I appreciate your answer. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me the questions and for allowing me to share that information as my colleagues are asking me and my constituents are asking me about comparisons to other states, not just regionally, but across the entire United States. And so thank you for allowing me to share that.
All right, Representative Lissigard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I want to thank you because in your opening remarks, you indicated that we're going to start to bring things forward and take a deeper dive into how we possibly can unwind this. So I think that's really important. To Mr. Huff, my question would be, getting back to Representative Freiberg's question, is that you've seen trends coming. And when you were going to make a decision, was part of your thought process to take into account when businesses have to purchase ahead of time the product that they're going to be selling? Because the people that I was speaking to, they were buying stuff and then they got 48 hours. Next thing you know, they're shut down and then they're stuck with all this product that they're paying. If they had a chance to restock, they had to pay for it. And the same thing with startup. It's hard to start and stop without adequate time. And so I'm sure that we're going to be looking at that with this process moving forward. But until then, if the dial is going to be turned, can you please work with the administration to make sure they're taking that into consideration for these small businesses?
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lissigard. Absolutely. You hit on a key, really a key challenge and problem for our businesses. We all need to plan, you know, I think in our food business, especially because food spoils. My field is originally environmental health, which is health inspection. So been in many, many kitchens, had many, many conversations with business owners in that industry. Maintaining product is key to a successful restaurant. When you don't know if you're going to be open next week, that just is an incredibly challenging environment. And we recognize that. We want to have the as much foresight as we can. Unfortunately, we don't have a crystal ball. One of the things that we know is the more that we as all Minnesotans really practice and take to heart masking, take to heart social distancing, getting tested regularly. All of these things make the swings less severe. I think of it as engine braking. When you're going downhill, you're putting in a low gear, and that just means you speed up less quickly. One of the challenges with this disease, and as I mentioned with the variants, right now we're looking at the measures are working. Minnesotans are doing an amazing job. We are seeing the numbers continue to improve. we would anticipate that that would continue as long as people are continuing their behaviors of masking, et cetera. The variants throw in this absolutely unknown for us, which make it very difficult and challenging for us to predict the future. Our goal is to give restaurants and other businesses as much of a heads up as possible. Unfortunately, sometimes things happen so quickly that we have to respond quickly. I just say, you know, it's when you're on the battlefield, things, the environment and the situation can change without warning. But thank you.
Representative Lizigard.
No further. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sandstedt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a couple of questions now, one for Mr. Huff and also one for Representative O'Neill, if she would clarify something in her presentation.
You want to go to Representative O'Neill first?
That would be fine.
Okay, Representative O'Neill.
Representative O'Neill, thank you for the presentation and the chart that you showed. I'm just curious, do you know of the states that were listed on that diagram, do all of those states currently have emergency powers for their governors?
Representative O'Neill.
I don't know for sure, but I recall a floor debate that said 49 out of 50 have some sort of emergency power within that. What, so just to clarify what the chart was across the bottom axis was increasing numbers of restrictions on the citizens, as in they weighted heavier, like business shutdowns and things like that were very onerous, where like a mask might be a lower score. And then across this axis going up was how many deaths in that state. But I only recall from the floor debate that 49 out of 50 currently have emergency powers right now.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My next question is for Mr. Huff. And Mr. Huff, or Deputy Commissioner Huff, my apologies. You made a comment that, and I'm going to try, I wrote this down. You said in your response to Representative Freiberg that you are in pretty frequent, or that you're colleagues were in very frequent and ongoing communication in terms of how to best manage the pandemic, best manage this virus. Can you comment on your thoughts on how well the administration was communicating with legislators during that time and since or throughout this almost 10 months?
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sandstedt. I'm not sure I can only comment from my own experience and that from my agency. I will say that, you know, since this response began, we've been having weekly meetings with various stakeholders, restaurant owners, businesses, sports teams, et cetera. And I know that from MDH, we have attempted to be as responsive as possible, working mostly with our chairs, Chair Liebling and Chair Benson, but also in being responsive to any questions that come up. I remember we talked, I think it was last summer, around testing on the Iron Range. I can't say, you know, from the administration perspective, but I know that each agency has been working to keep their chairs up to date. As you know, have been providing since really the beginning of the pandemic, our data report, everything that we have as far as our updated daily, our weekly daily, trying to make sure that is as transparent for actually everyone in Minnesota, but especially for our legislative leadership. I would say, you know, have we done enough communication? I don't think you can do too much communication. I know that at times we have been just nose to the grindstone, responding to emergencies, responding to issues. You know, I wish that we could meet with everyone every day and discuss where we are in things, and that has not necessarily been possible. I'm not sure if I'm actually providing much of an answer to your question, but it's more of just my personal reflection on my own perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for those comments. I would just like to share that I think through the course of 7 special sessions, there has been an increasing level of frustration that I am aware of within the body of not really having the access to administration, not hearing responses from the administration, maybe in as timely a manner that would have been helpful. And you also made a comment when you were talking to Representative Freiberg that we are at war with an unpredictable enemy. And I'm going to agree with you on that, but I'm going to also expand on that. Because right now we are at war with an unpredictable enemy, but it's not just the pandemic. It is the level of frustration that people are feeling across our state and our inability to really communicate where we are in all of this. I'm a teacher. I believe in SMART goals, which are time-bound. I know a pandemic is not time-bound, but we do have to have some plans in place. And I am grateful for this committee because I think that is the work that we're going to be doing. And that's exactly what we're trying to get at. But I do need to make people aware the level of frustration among the common person across our state is escalating. And we've seen this on even the national level with the rioting that has gone on. And we are certainly starting to see an increase across the state. And I just think the more that we can do to be in communication with one another, 3 co-equal branches of government working effectively to communicate the same message, the better off every Minnesotan will be in understanding where we are and what our plan to exit, you know, the current situation would be. So for what that's worth, I would appreciate it if you would just take those words and share them with your administration.
I see him, Representative Stanson, he's nodding and smiling, which are 2 good things. So we'll take both of those.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is for you and getting back to our agenda for today. I would like to have us talk about the executive order relating to business closures and I guess focus on the here and now. Our positivity rate right now is 3.4%. That is our lowest since July and getting closer to our record 7-day positivity rate low of 2.75, which was in June. I'd like to talk about the here and now and the positive position that we are in right now in managing this pandemic and the work of this committee, as Representative Sandsteed said, is what is our pathway forward. So just wanted to ask you, for our next half hour or so, where we can take getting it back to your agenda.
I'm open for any questions that you might have at this point, and you can ask away. Commissioner Huff is going to be here till the end of the hearing if you want to point those corrections at, or questions at him, or are you pointing him to the chair?
I guess, Mr. Chair, my understanding of the agenda was talking about one of the things on your agenda was talking about the emergency order. I don't have the number right in front of me, but related to business closures.
Representative Haley, if you took a look at the agenda,
maybe it changed.
We had two of the executive orders that were on the agenda: the ensuring businesses provide safe environments and the mask issue. Both of those were covered in the presentation that Assistant Commissioner Huff did last Friday. If we wanted any more detailed questions on those, we were going to cover those today. And moving forward, I would hope that we would cover them in more detail, particularly now that we have some substance that will be coming before the committee next week. We have one bill, for instance, by Representative Jordan. We have Representative Doubt's bill. We have Representative Baker is coming up with, and I'm hopeful his was specifically on the business closures. So right now, we've more or less covered what we were going to cover with the agenda last week and then into this week. If you have more questions, though, today, happy to try to field them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask the Assistant Commissioner a question on vaccines then.
All right. Assistant Commissioner or Representative Haley, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner, it is my understanding and having talked with many leaders of our healthcare systems that if we can vaccinate 70% of 65-year-olds, 65 and plus, that we can eliminate 90% of our hospitalizations and our deaths. And I'm concerned that our vaccination plan is not effective right now. We have a lot of frustration from our constituents on changing procedures, changing models. I'd like to know from your position, what are we gonna do to get these vaccinations out to the folks that are most risk of this disease? And I ask that because it's so closely tied then to our next move in getting our businesses reopened and our kids back to school. Thank you,
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Haley, more than happy to let me, I'll definitely address your question. I do want to just point out though that if we want a full brief in on vaccination, then that's better to come from Commissioner Malcolm and our infectious disease director, Chris Ayersman. But I'm more than happy to answer your question. First of all, the plan changed at the federal level. We had planned, we'd actually worked with the federal government, the CDC, in our first plan, we were focused really on just 1A, which is long-term care, and then folks who are actually exposed or potentially exposed to people that are infectious. So healthcare workers, first responders, et cetera. Previous administration changed that with messaging to say, well, vaccinate everybody in the one category, everyone above 65, anyone that's a critical worker, and anyone that has an underlying health condition. That changed our planning because where we had about 500,000 people that we needed to vaccinate, we were now over 2 million people to vaccinate. However, the supply did not change. There was a lot of messaging, I think this is one, I know this is one of the frustrations that has been shared by many executive branches in all the states, is what would appear to be a blaming of the states. Now, we're in a difficult situation as a country. There is a limited supply of vaccine. We want more vaccine. As our infectious disease director, Chris Ayersman, said on a media call, I think a week ago, it's probably the most painful thing for a public health professional to have people want a vaccine and not be able to give it. However, we have pivoted and we have continued to pivot as both the guidance has changed and the allocation has changed. One of the things I like to, describe when we look at how our vaccinations being administered, we have multiple pathways for a vaccine to be administered. We have our healthcare partners, your doctor, your clinic. We have our pharmacy partners. They're working with, as you know, the pharmacy partnership program, working to vaccinate long-term care. We have our colleagues in local public health who are experienced in doing stand-up vaccination clinics. We have our state clinic sites. And all of these are important avenues. The reason they're important is we need to get 100% coverage, or rather we need to have everyone that wants a vaccine, 100% of those folks have access to vaccine in Minnesota. And we also want to make sure that we vaccinate for impact. That is, we vaccinate those people who are more vulnerable because they're older or in long-term care, those that are more likely to be exposed because of their work, and then also those that are so important for our other societal goals. You mentioned getting kids back into school. So in it's always difficult to say, well, how do you ration? You know, who is a, you know, more worthy person than another person? And that's, I think we, you know, I'm sure any two people in a given room, we're going to have two different opinions on that. But I can give you an idea of how the conversation has gone. It's really looking for impact. So continuing to focus on long-term care, our healthcare professionals, those who are 65 and over, but then adding our educators so that they know they can safely return to school and get kids back in school. As we work on all these different streams that I mentioned, healthcare, pharmacies, state clinics, local public health, that's an amazing amount of complexity. It would be faster and easier if we just all did it ourselves. But I go back to the old adage of, if you want to go fast, go by yourself. But if you want to go farther or go the distance, you go together. And we're in this for the long haul. That's why we are working so diligently with so many different partners. It means that it is more complex at the beginning. It means that we do have to pilot and pivot and learn to see what the best way for all of these various mechanisms. But I think in the end, it's going to mean that we will go farther and we will have much better saturation. This pandemic is not going to be won in the first weeks of a vaccine distribution system when we're getting such limited vaccine. It's going to be won by how much coverage we actually get and how much saturation of the vaccine throughout the entire program. I feel quite proud of the work that we're doing. I feel proud that we're a learning organization, that we are pivoting, that we are building upon our assets and our strengths, and that we actually are getting vaccine and our pace is increasing at the same time that we're dealing with so many different partners that'll help us achieve that saturation. Thank you.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. I guess I need to speak on behalf of my constituents who would say that the process has not been smooth at all. They are familiar with going to their providers, their very competent healthcare providers in their local communities to get a shot and to get a vaccine. And they have not had that opportunity. The process is unduly complex. And you can say that there's not enough supply from the federal government, and we can debate that. We know more vaccines are being approved and are coming. But the facts show that Minnesota has lagged the country in getting vaccines out. That is the chief frustration. We need to do better, and we need to focus on the age group that is so severely impacted by this disease. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner.
All right. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to kind of bring us back to what we're talking about here. The issue of vaccine distribution, we're talking about the governor's emergency authority. Obviously, the issue of vaccine distribution is one of the most critical issues we're facing right now as a state. We've had hearings in multiple committees in the House, and I know the Senate has as well on that issue. We're talking about the governor's emergency authority, and the governor has actually not really used his emergency authority on the issue of vaccines very much. So I actually asked House Research to look into this. The only executive order related to vaccines is Executive Order 20-107, which allows out-of-state pharmacists to be engaged by a Minnesota hospital or healthcare provider and to administer COVID-19 vaccines in the state without being licensed in Minnesota. Just based on the discussions we've been having related to the desire to move past the emergency declaration, I did actually ask for that for a bill to be drafted codifying that executive order, and I'm waiting to receive it. And we could certainly talk about that here if you want to, Mr. Chair. But otherwise, just generally, the whole issue of vaccine distribution and prioritization has been a matter of MDH policy, relying on guidance of the federal government and its advisory committees. So I think this is, for the most part, this is probably a discussion that's better to be had in the health committees, and we have been having that discussion there.
All right. Representative Ogema.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner Huff, while we're on the subject of vaccines, I want to take the moment to commend you and everyone at MDH and the administration for really doing a quick and efficient pivot, given how much has changed from the guidelines from the feds. I know they have not put you in an easy situation, and I know that you all have been working overtime to navigate that and adjust to that. So thank you for that. I also want to commend you for something that Representative O'Neill's chart reminded us all of, is for all of your work to make sure that Minnesota is on the low end of the death rate compared to other states who have been dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. Now, one death is too many. And again, I know that you all have been working overtime making those tough decisions, but it really does show that what you at MDH have done, what the administration has done, has been a success. And what really breaks my heart is when you take a look at that chart and you look at those states, just to think, what if other governors, other administrations had the thoughtful approach that Governor Wallace has had and that you and MDH have had? Their numbers would be lower and our numbers would be lower as well. So thank you for the work that you're doing. And I know that myself and all my colleagues are grateful that the MDH and the administration are willing to work with us and be partners with the legislature to make sure that we can respond to this pandemic together. So thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to briefly get back to the point about the comparison to the other states. Maybe this is a nice build on Representative Wolgamott's point. And I guess in particular, the comparison with the states around us. And we saw some of that in the chart, Commissioner, that you put in front of us. And I'm also just looking at stats showing that the per capita, in terms of per capita cases around the country, the Dakotas are number one and number two, and then Wisconsin number seven, Iowa number eight, and then we're number 26. So you got four of the top eight states. And I feel like we often hear from colleagues who represent border communities about the challenge of having regulation on the Minnesota side of the line, and then you cross the line, it's different. But it feels like in this case, it really could work backwards. Can you talk about the challenge of when we're surrounded by states that do have fewer restrictions and then much higher case counts than we do, but the challenge in that situation of kind of, it seems like that would end up driving up our count even despite our restrictions because of the states, what's happening in the states around us.
Assistant Commissioner Huff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto, it's always difficult for us to say, you know, well, where exactly is the spread coming from? However, we do see that the counties and the areas that border our sister states have seen a higher increase. In fact, some of the western counties and then that southwestern corner where you, between South Dakota and Iowa, those have persistently been some of the highest counties for case counts. I think I may have mentioned last time, there's a misnomer or a myth that the metro is the hotbed of the virus, and that just has not been the case for many, many months. It really is our border counties or the western counties, the southern counties, and then some of those eastern ones. I think the other thing that's important is one of the things that impacts our hospital capacity, you know, we are a regional medical center. We are home to some of the best healthcare in the world. And we have many people in our neighboring states that use our healthcare system. Now, we have Minnesotans that use a healthcare system in Wisconsin or the Dakotas as well. But we definitely have felt the strain in our own healthcare system from other states when their cases are not as controlled, who use Minnesota beds because it's a regional resource. But I would say that it has been a challenge for us. You know, you can't build a wall around your state. People travel. People work on either side of the border. People socialize with each other. And when you have an area where those restrictions do not exist, those protections do not exist, you're going to have more spread. And that has been, I think, one of the drivers for Minnesota. You know, and I think the one chart where I showed that we started an increase later than, say, the Dakotas, and we didn't increase as much, but we lagged behind them. And I think it's because our measures were doing that engine braking, we're slowing it down, but it's very difficult when you have such high cases right in your sister states.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for that. And I'll just note in work that I do in other areas, early childhood and combating gender violence, I work with staff at the Department of Health, and the analogy you keep on going back to, Commissioner, about a war, I've really seen that people who have other jobs, you, like your department has, and for the past year, has just completely been on a war footing and taking every person and just putting them to work. And I'm just thinking of somebody in particular that I was emailing with who on the, you know, the job description is now, in addition to what that person was doing, they're on the COVID front lines and their job would never have been that, but you've got every person doing it. So I just thank you for your work. And Mr. Chair, I'm really looking forward to having our subject matter experts on the committees then really diving into a number of these issues to say, where do we take the executive orders, put them in the law, what changes do we do, how do we work things? Anyway, looking forward to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess first I want to say thank you for creating the space to have this conversation here in this committee, and also to the Assistant Commissioner Huff for being here today. As I've been listening to the commissioner talk, very strategic about the process that they have put in place to really protect citizens, which is hard to say because I know within my community, which I'm going to say right now is the Black community, that COVID has hit our communities and families really, really hard. And it has hit our community really hard, I know and believe, because one, you know, we don't often take the medical profession at its word. Sometimes we do not trust government for many, many different reasons. And because of that, we looked as if it was about someone else and not about our community, not recognizing that the pre-existing conditions that is a really big part of our community was not really stated early in the process, really clear enough so that we can see that, yes, it is going, yeah, of course, it's going to, you know, it has no predictor of who you are and where you are or how much money you have or what color you are. That does not matter. I appreciate the analogy of this here disease, this virus, using that war analogy, because it doesn't care. It just shows up and it just spreads and impacts people, families, communities, children. But that analogy that we are at war with an enemy, and this enemy is this virus, it just speaks to me so much. And then to hear the assistant commissioner said that, I think our word, that this pushing the enemy back, that, you know, the governor and this administration has been working to push this enemy back, but this enemy has foot soldiers. Yes, foot soldiers that is on the rise here, right? Don't know whether or not this additional strain, this P1 strain has reached Minnesota. But, you know, as easily as we saw this COVID-19 enter Minnesota, into our state, so can we see this additional strain impact our state if we're not very intentional about really following the simple recommendations that's coming from COVID, from the CDC, to wear a mask, to, you know, social distance, to just follow those recommendations for the businesses. And I understand because I had COVID. I had COVID the first week in April. Mm. April the 2nd, I was in my home with COVID-19. That did not just impact me, but it impacted my family. And so, you know, it's hard. It's tough being not able to do all the things. I have a grandson who was able who's 18 for the first time voted, but also for the first time is trying to, you know, has been an honor student all his life. And now is not doing so well in school because of this distant learning. But it's something that has to happen. It's something that that our students have to do. It has impacted our businesses. None of us enjoy this, but we are saving lives. And our numbers is down because what we saw from Representative O'Neill is because of the guidelines that we have in Minnesota. Now, I would just end by saying this in regards to, you know, wanting to end the governor's, you know, executive order in his ability to, his executive order power. I have watched us in this body, in this legislative body, over simple issues, simple products, projects, not being able to agree on simple issues that we would think that we as a body can agree to and move things forward in a timely way. And I have to just say, I would not want in this time of a war that we are in with this virus, would I want to put that type of emergency decision in the legislative body's hand to do the right thing and do it in a way that will be done immediately. We don't operate that way in this body. We don't now, and we never have, and I don't think we are capable and able to do it with this virus. And so, in the midst of the hardship that we all hate, in the midst of distant learning that we do not agree with, and I would agree with you too, but one life lost, two life lost, I think, I don't know the number that we're up to right now, so I'm not going to name that number, but it's way too many. Every life is precious, and way too many lives have been lost as we have been surrounded by border states who don't have enough strict restrictions that has caused us to move place by place, that has inundated our hospital, and here we are. And so with all that, I do not have a question for the Commissioner Huff. I think we've heard from him, the strategic plan, you know, and so I just wanted to make that comment because I just do not feel that we in this body are capable and able to move at a speed that will be necessary to ensure that another life, another family, another community or town will be impacted in a very negative way if we were to open it up the way many want us to open up. We have our obligations to protect folks across this country. And I thank the governor who we have put this exorbitant burden on to do this in a way that can be effective. So anyway, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you for calling on me, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, Mr. Chairman, the reason why I like you is because I know that I can be blunt with you and I don't need to worry about violating your safe space or hurting your feelings that, you know, you take the praise with the criticism. So I actually do not want to thank you for today's committee hearing because all I've heard is an hour and 15 minutes of guest lectures and politicians talking about themselves. That's all I've heard. There's a lot of people. I want to echo comments Representative Sandstead said earlier, right? There's a lot of people watching this today who have lost faith in the ability of their government to represent their concerns. They see the arbitrary decisions that are happening and they're sick of it. And an increasing number of Minnesotans are just starting to ignore these executive orders, not just the bad ones, not just the ones that are meaningless and fact-free. They're starting to ignore all of them. And this is a problem for all of us. So the conversations we're having in this committee, I need some very direct answers from my majority party colleagues, right? And if the answer to this is not yes, I don't need a soliloquy, I don't need a lecture on it, but are you willing to end the Chapter 12 powers? Yes or no? Is there a DFLer on this call who's willing to end those Chapter 12 powers right now? Because if the answer is not yes, then we won't talk about it. We'll talk about something else. But is there any DFLer who wants to end those right now?
Representative
Garofalo. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry.
Well, Representative Garofalo, I think that's been answered on the House floor repeatedly recently with votes. So,
Mr. Chairman, recently, yesterday,
in fact.
Yep. And so, but those are procedural motions and people kind of hide behind those. But so that, it's good for my colleagues to know that instead of trying to beat up DFLers or cajole or, you know, you guys aren't going to end the Chapter 12 powers. Okay. I disagree with it, but let's move on to another issue. Can we at least require affirmative legislative approval for any new executive orders from the governor? Can we do that? Are there DFLers in this call who are like,
Representative Garofalo, when I was asked to convert this committee into the topic that we are now going through, I had repeatedly stated over the course of seven special sessions that what I had wanted to do was to engage the legislature on this topic with the executive branch, which became impossible in a 1 or 2 day special session. And to the very best of our ability, we're attempting to do that now. And we're doing it in a committee. We're doing it with the public watching us. And hopefully we will be reviewing those items that were talked about on the House floor, but which we could not have a hearing on or fully understand by a simple conversation on the House floor. So I am hopeful, particularly next week, that we can take a thorough look at the various proposals that have been made in regards to Chapter 12 and come to some agreement of how we wish to adopt Chapter 12 so that there would be legislative involvement with the executive branch in the future.
Well, but Mr. Chairman, if I may, respectfully, that's not what's happening right now. And we just had a member of the DFL caucus say they look forward to seeing the governor's executive orders put into statute. I'm not interested in that. I mean, that's why I'm trying to figure out the role of this subcommittee is correcting the problem that exists. And the problem is not the individual decisions Tim Walz is making. He's made good decisions. He's made bad decisions. That's not the issue. The issue is one person has been ruling the state for over 10 months. And so that's why when I ask a question like, can we require legislative approval for new executive orders? So that if the legislature doesn't affirmatively do that, the executive order doesn't go into effect. Is that something that is on the table, or should I not waste my time trying to get this drafted and brought to this committee?
Representative Garofalo, that would be on the table.
Okay. So it's good. So we have options like, can the legislature require affirmative legislative action to end the peacetime emergency? Is that
Representative Garofalo, all of those items would be on the table, and I think they would deserve a hearing, a public hearing, so that we would have a full understanding of exactly what those mean.
Right, and but how Mr. Chairman, we could accomplish the problem that. Is that's not what's taking place. What's taking place is a debate about the decisions the governor is using his executive power to administer. That's what's happening right now. And I can just tell you, I'm just channeling what my social media feed, what my emails are saying. There are people whose lives are being destroyed by these arbitrary decisions by the governor, right? There's no doubt some of the decisions the governor's made have been right, right? But yesterday you heard Representative Crescia eloquently state how the governor is destroying these wedding facilities, the wedding industries, caterers, right? And there is there's no scientific basis whatsoever to justify why 120 people can be in one restaurant, but because they're a wedding event, they can only have 13, right? And I'm not debating the policy. What I'm debating is that one person should not have the authority to do that. And so that's, again, Mr. Chairman, you know I like you. You're a good dude. I don't like how the committee hearing is going. I wasn't a fan of how it was a week ago. If there are DFLers who are, if this is going to be about validating and codifying the governor's decisions, count me out. Okay. That's someone else's job. That's a political issue. If there are DFLers who are interested in changing these laws so we can actually get some checks and balances into it, will you please reach out to me? Because right now I'm not seeing any of it, Mr. Chairman. I'm seeing more of a CYA attempt by the administration. And I'm just not interested in that. So. But I hope you have a good weekend, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for letting me on.
Representative Sandstedt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to respond to Representative Garofalo, I think that there are many people who are mostly interested in determining
collectively determining whether or not we need emergency powers, yes or no, which to me is not clear. When 48 or 49 states still have emergency powers, my question would be, and I hope that we can get to this, why would Minnesota be exempt from that? And then to your next point about executive orders, absolutely. Count me in saying the legislature needs to be involved. We are supposed to be co-equal branches. My question would go back to leadership. Why during special sessions were decisions left up to five individuals and not the body? Because that affected every side of the aisle. Now, we don't need to sit, and I'm not remotely interested in pointing fingers right now. But we are where we are. There's 48 other states besides Minnesota that have emergency powers. There's got to be a reason for that. They're not all Democratic states. They're not all Republican states. The executive orders are things that need to be discussed. I would love to find a solution moving forward. Count me in. I will be part of that process. But don't give up yet. That is what we are supposed to do in this committee. Maybe some people have different opinions than I do, but I'm ready to move forward to ensure that we can protect Minnesotans, that we can keep people safe, that we can protect our small businesses, and for sure that we can get our kids back into the classroom and ensure a solid education and make sure they are protected and the teachers and the paras and the staff are all safe to do so. It's a big issue, but I have confidence if we work together and put the rhetoric aside and quit the polarization and the game playing on the floor about procedural motions, et cetera. Yeah, we can do that. But that's going to take a commitment from both sides of the aisle. And when we can put those games away, I'm in. I'm ready to work.
Representative Wolgamott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Sandstein. I think you put it very perfectly. I want to reiterate a lot of what you said. Representative Garofalo, we're here today, we're here last week, we're here doing this work because we want to work in good faith efforts as a legislature, as Republicans, as Democrats. We want to respond to the governor. He sent us a letter laying out very clearly that he wants to work with the legislature. He wants to partner with us as we bring the voices of our constituents to this process to keep Minnesotans safe and help respond to this pandemic. Simply ending the state of emergency isn't going to make the COVID-19 pandemic go away. It's going to kill people. It's going to cost human lives. So we need to work together. We need to have a plan in place. We are, as Representative Pulaski has mentioned, we're going to be hearing bills in this committee from Republican authors and DFL authors. That's why we're here doing this work. So I hope that you will not walk away from this. I hope that you'll continue to work in good faith with DFL members of this committee, that you'll work in good faith with the governor, the administration. That's why I'm grateful that Assistant Commissioner Huff has been here this week and last week to answer our questions, to go into detail about what the response has been so that we can use that information to work together going forward. So that's why we're here, the legislature, working with the governor to respond to this pandemic and bring the voices of our constituents to this process. And I hope you won't take your ball and go home. I hope you'll continue to join us in this life-saving work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lisligard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Garofalo, I love you being candid, so I'm going to be candid. I have conversations with you today with Representative Barb Haley and then also with Representative Dowd. I spoke to Representative Dowd for 36 minutes about 3 weeks ago. And he brought up a case about why the emergency powers needed to be, we just needed to get rid of them. And I was honest with him there, and I'll be honest with you today. I don't think all the emergency powers can be eliminated. And I won't do the all or nothing. Do I believe that the governor should have all saying power? Heck no. That's why I'm here, and that's why I want to mix it up. I want to mix it up with the commissioners, saying how are they making these decisions? Because we do have to have a voice. And I want to be at the table with all of us. And I just heard our chair say that we are going to be bringing things forward. I am going to be working with Representative Haley on her bill. But it's not going to be all or nothing. And I'm not going to support stripping everything away just to appease some far right whack jobs that are trying to intimidate people on this committee. It's not going to happen. It's not who I am. We're going to go through this process and we're going to try to figure it out together. And I know you're candid. I'm candid. And I would love to have the conversation. I'd like to go side by side with you so we can do this together.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the members. I always love when this moment happens where you kind of spend a whole bunch of time, you know, talking about nothing, and then somebody gets frustrated and they just say what they want to say. And while it might seem uncomfortable or whatever, it's actually good because it gets everybody's feelings out there, and we can just talk about how we all feel this needs to move forward. I want to address Representative Sandstead first. We have heard of the stuff that's going on, you know, these crazy whack jobs showing up outside of members' homes, trying to intimidate them. This has no place in our state or in our government. And the people who run these organizations are fraudsters. These are not legitimate organizations. They exist for the purpose of raising money and only for that purpose. The people who frankly run them should be publicized and run out of the state. They're literally in this to make money. And the tactics they use are unacceptable. For somebody to show up outside of somebody's house and try to intimidate a lawmaker into changing their vote on something is absolutely unacceptable. And I will speak out as loudly as anybody against it. But I also want you to know, it's not just happening on your side. These folks from those groups attack us as well, and we don't like it either. So, but that's not the reason to do any of this. The reason to do this is, frankly, and I appreciate Representative Garofalo speaking up. Sometimes he says this things a little more abruptly than we like to hear, but it's good because it forces the conversation. I want to respond to your comment about games on the floor. I hope you don't view them as games, and I just really sincerely, we don't mean them to be games. We have very limited avenues to actually have these conversations, and we have 10 months or 11 months worth of frustration bottled up in us. And I just really sincerely believe that the governor has a very difficult time justifying that we have emergency powers in place when we have a legislature that's in session. And he's issuing executive orders at the rapid clip of about once every 30 days. This isn't an emergency anymore. It's a big deal. It's a pandemic. It's a crisis. But under the definition of Chapter 12, it is no longer an emergency. He doesn't need to act quickly on these things. And the pace of his executive orders demonstrate that. Now, in his defense, the legislature has not responded in a way to really show that we're ready to govern. I think we can do that quickly. That's why I support ending the emergency powers immediately. The bill that I brought in the spring and that we'll talk about hopefully next week basically eliminated the governor's ability to have emergency powers under Chapter 12 and created a new public health emergency, which gave him some limited ability to do some things to protect Minnesotans. But it interjected the legislature back into that process by allowing us to end an emergency order. And we will talk about that next week. I also think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Sandstead brought up a good point. In the 48 states, while yes, 48 or 49 states do have emergency powers or 48 other states, many of those are very different than ours. In fact, quite a few of the states require that the legislature must vote to extend the emergency powers. And they also vote that they must extend or approve executive orders after a certain period of time. So almost no other state has it just like ours. So it is a rather generalized statement to say that. But you have my commitment. It's time, just for the good of the institution of the legislature, that we figure out a way to ramp down this emergency powers and get back to a regular scenario where the legislature is involved in that process. If that means we create some new powers for the governor to respond quickly in the event that he needs to in a public health emergency, let's do that. But this has gone on, I think, long enough. And so let's together as a group, a bipartisan group, figure out the best way to ramp this down. Let's do that quickly so that my constituents have a voice, because right now they can't contact the governor and they rely on me to be their voice at the Capitol. And I feel like I can't do that job because the governor has cut me out of that process. And I think many of you feel the same way. So thanks for letting me.
Members, we're technically out of time. I see Representative Pinto would have been next. If you can make it extremely brief, but we are out of time.
I know I lowered my hand, Mr. Chair.
Oh, all right. Members, we're going to have a rather full agenda next week. Any of you who want to be on that agenda, and I know we've got Representative Haley, Representative Baker, Representative Dowd, but if there are others, work with us over the coming week, and we are going to start again with probably Representative Dowd or Representative Haley Baker. We'll see which one wants to go first on this. So with that, members, thank you. This was a rather interesting discussion, and I'm sure we'll have even more next week. Thank you. Meeting is adjourned.